USA is a slice of a continent. USA is a group of holding companies, some aggregations of trade unions, a set of laws bound in calf, a radio network, a chain of moving picture theaters, a column of stock quotations rubbed out and written in by a Western Union boy on a blackboard, a public library full of old newspapers and dog-eared history books with protests scrawled on the margins in pencil. USA is the letters at the end of an address when you're away from home. But mostly, USA is the speech of the people.
The words you have just heard are from John Dos Passos' trilogy of novels called USA. This program is Americana, the first in a series of radio essays on the American scene, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Tonight, we bring you Enclosures for a Cornerstone.
Good evening. I'm Martin Maloney of the School of Speech at Northwestern University. This is a new series of radio essays presented jointly by station WMAQ and Northwestern University, which deals with the fragments, the oddities, the experiences and recollections which go together to make American life and eventually American history. To those of you who listened to our last year's series of similar broadcasts called The Meaning of America, we extend a hearty welcome back. To those of you who are new listeners, we venture to hope that you may, as soon as possible, become old listeners. We hope that you will, as so many of you did last year, write us your suggestions and comments. They are more than welcome. Let us see tonight if we can fill one of those stereotyped cornerstones, the sort of thing that is traditionally opened some centuries hence by our remote grandchildren, or perhaps by somebody like Macaulay's New Zealander inspecting the ruins of London, or perhaps even by a Martian or Venusian peering at the remains of a planet. Imagine the situation. Here, in this little box of granite or metal, is enclosed our final testament, our self-explanation, our letter to the world, as Emily Dickinson once phrased it. What shall we say? What shall we say that America was like? Perhaps we need not imagine it. Do you remember that magnificent short story of Stephen Vincent Benet's called By the Waters of Babylon? It tells of a boy, the son of a priest, in a tribe which must be very like an early American Indian tribe. This is the story of the boy's coming of age, his initiation into the priesthood. After the rituals have been performed upon him, he goes out alone into the forest to dream his dreams and to make his magics. And his dreams provide him with such strong medicine that he is inspired to go not simply to the dead places, which are forbidden to all save priests, but even to travel far off to the great dead place, the place of the gods. One of the remaining towers of this ruined city he enters, and in a room of the tower he eats and sleeps.
I woke in the midst of the night. When I woke, the fire had gone out and I was cold. It seemed to me that all around me there were whisperings of voices. Some will say that I slept again, but I do not think that I slept. I had stepped out of my body. I could see my body asleep in front of the cold fire, but it was not I. I was drawn to look out upon the city of the gods. It should have been dark, for it was night. But it was not dark. Everywhere there were lights. Lines of lights, circles and blurs of lights. 10,000 torches would not have been the same. The city itself was alight. You could barely see the stars for the glow in the sky. I thought to myself, this is strong magic, and trembled. There was a roaring in my ears, like the rushing of rivers. And then my eyes grew used to the light and my ears to the sound. I knew that I was seeing the city as it had been when the gods were alive. Oh, that was a sight indeed. Yes, that was a sight. I could not have seen it in my body. My body would have died. Everywhere went the gods on foot and in chariots. There were gods beyond number and counting, and their chariots blocked the streets. They had turned night to day for their pleasure and did not sleep with the sun. The noise of their coming and the going was the noise of many waters. It was magic what they could do. It was magic what they did. I looked out of another window. The great vines of their bridges were mended. The god roads went east and west. Reckless were the gods and always in motion. They bored tunnels under rivers. They flew in the air. With unbelievable tools, they did giant works. No part of the earth was safe from them. For if they wished for a thing, they summoned it from the other side of the world. And always as they feasted and made love, there was a drum in their ears. The pulse of a giant city beating, beating like a man's heart. It is not for the metal alone we go to the dead places now. There are the books and the writings. They are hard to learn. The magic tools are broken. But we can look at them and wonder. At least we make a beginning. And when I am chief priest, we shall go beyond the great river. We shall go to the place of the gods. The place New York. Not one man, but a company. We shall look for the images of the gods and find the god Ashing and the others, the gods Lincoln, Biltmore, and Moses. But they were men who built the city, not gods or demons. They were men. They were men who were here before us. We must build again.
Is Mr. Benet's vision of the future perhaps a little too somber for you? If it is, I apologize, although not very sincerely, for I am extremely fond of Benet's stories and particularly of this one. But for our own cornerstone, our little collection of mementos, I quite agree we should not try to catch Benet's somber and tragic version of American life. Instead, let us say that for the first item in our cornerstone, we shall include one song, a gay and delightful American tune.
As I was going on down the road, tired team and a heavy load, cracked my whip and the leader sprung, said hey, hey to the wagon tongue, turkey and straw, turkey and hay, roll them up and twist them up a high, took a haul and hit them up a tune called Turkey and Straw. Went on to milk and I didn't know how. Milked the goat instead of the cow. Monkey sitting on a pile of straw. Winking at his mother-in-law. Turkey and straw. Turkey and hay. Roll him up and twist him up a high. Took a haul and hit him up a tune called Turkey and Straw. Oh, I came to a river and I couldn't get across. Paid $5 for an old blind horse. Wouldn't go ahead and he wouldn't stand still. Went up and down like an old sawmill. Turkey and straw, turkey and hay. Roll him up and twist him up a high, tuck a haul, and sing him up a tune called Turkey in the Straw.
While we're making up our collection of American mementos, we should include one item which covers a great deal of territory in a very brief space. I'm not sure how many people nowadays read John Dos Passos' great trilogy of novels called USA. Perhaps not even Mr. Dos Passos himself does anymore, for my impression is that he has changed his ideas of American life rather radically in late years, so that perhaps these novels, which must certainly stand as his major literary work, may seem to him in some sense youthful follies. For my part, I don't think that any American, especially if he loves good writing, should go through life without reading these three books of John Dos Passos. The first of the three novels, which is called The 42nd Parallel, has by way of preface a brief sketch, half rhetoric, half poetry, which is simply headed USA.
It was not through the long walks through jostling crowds at night that he was less alone, or in the training camp at Allentown, or on the day in the docks at Seattle, or on the empty reek of Washington City hot boyhood summer nights, or on the meal on Market Street, or on the swim off the red rocks at San Diego, or on the bed full of fleas in New Orleans, or on the cold, razor-like wind off the lake, or on the grave faces trembling in the grind of gears in the street under Michigan Avenue, or on the smokers of limited express trains, or riding up the dry mountain canyons, or the night without a sleeping bag among frozen bear tracks in the Yellowstone, or canoeing Sundays on the Quinnipiac. But in his mother's words, telling about long ago, and his father's telling about when I was a boy, in the kidding stories of uncle, in the lies the kids told at school, the hired men's yarns, the tall tales the doughboys told after taps, it was the speech that clung to the ear, the link that tingled in the blood, USA. USA is a slice of a continent. USA is a group of holding companies, some aggregations of trade unions, a set of laws bound in calf, a radio network, a chain of moving picture theaters, a column of stock quotations rubbed out and written in by a Western Union boy on a blackboard, a public library full of old newspapers and dog-eared history books with protests scrawled on the margins in pencil. USA is the world's greatest river valley, fringed with mountains and hills. USA is the letters at the end of an address when you're away from home. But mostly, USA is the speech of the people.
USA is the speech of the people. A speech that is sometimes spoken and repeated, sometimes written down, sometimes chanted or sung. A speech that remembers past tragedies and human courage. We should not want the future to forget, I suppose, that Americans suffered the blows of nature as well as man.
In Galveston's a seawall to keep the water down, but the high tide from the ocean washed water over the town. Well, their trumpets gave them warning, you'd better leave this place. They never thought of leaving till death looked them in the face. Wasn't that a mighty storm? Oh, wasn't that a mighty storm with water? Wasn't that a mighty storm that blew the people away? The trains, they were all loaded with people leaving town. The tracks give way from the ocean, the trains, they went on down. Oh, the trees fell on the island, the houses give away. Some people strived and drowned, some died most every way. Oh, wasn't that a mighty storm? Oh, wasn't that a mighty storm with water? Wasn't that a mighty storm that blew the people away? The lightning played around them, the thunder began to roar, the wind began a blowing, the rain began to fall, the sea began a rolling, the ships they could not land. I heard the captain crying, please save a drowning man. Oh, wasn't that a mighty storm? Oh, wasn't that a mighty storm with water? Wasn't that a mighty storm that blew the people away?
We should not represent America fairly if we did not remember that she has had her black spokesmen and her red ones as well as white. In the cold light of eternity, I suppose it must seem strange that a difference in skin pigmentation could make so much difference to the history of a great nation. But as any American knows, of course, this has been the fact. How shall we represent this situation for our cornerstone? Perhaps by some words spoken by Frederick Douglass. Born a slave in Maryland in 1817, later journalist, orator, freedman, diplomat, and American. In 1865, Douglass spoke at the annual meeting of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society at Boston on the subject, What the Black Man Wants. Let us listen to a part of his address.
I think the American people are disposed often to be generous rather than just. I look over this country at this present time and I see educational societies, sanitary commissions, freedmen associations, and the like. All very good. But in regard to the colored people, there's always more than his benevolence than just manifested toward us. What I ask for the Negro is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simple justice. The American people have always been anxious to know what they shall do with us. I have had but one answer from the very beginning. Do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us. If the apples will not remain on the tree of their own strength, if they're worm-eaten at the core, if they're early ripe and disposed to fall, let them fall. And if the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall also. All I ask is, give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone. If you see him on his way to school, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going to the dinner table at a hotel, let him go. If you see him going to the ballot box, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going into a workshop, just let him alone. If the Negro cannot live by the wine of eternal justice, the fault will not be yours. It will be his who made the Negro and established that line for his government. Let him live or die by that. If you will only untie his hands and give him a chance, I think he will live.
The red man's troubles are long since forgotten by most Americans, except when they go to rather bad movies. But once they were real enough. There are perhaps no more striking episodes in American history than those occasional ones in which great Indian leaders, who were often highly civilized, able, and wise men, faced their white oppressors. One of the greatest of the Indian chiefs was Tecumseh, the Shawnee who died fighting the Americans during the War of 1812. Tecumseh was a wise man, a great military leader, and an extremely eloquent speaker. One of the most remarkable of his speeches which survives to us is the one which he addressed to Governor Harrison at a council in Vincennes in 1810.
It is true. I am a Shawnee. My forefathers were warriors. Their son is a warrior. From them I take only my existence. From my tribe I take nothing. I am the maker of my own fortune. And oh, that I could make that of my red people and of my country as great as the conception of my mind when I think of the spirit that rules the universe. I would not then come to Governor Harrison to ask him to tear the treaty, to obliterate the landmark. But I would say to him, Sir, you have liberty to return to your own country. The being within, communing with past ages, tells me that once, nor until lately, there was no white man on this continent. Let it then all belong to red men, children of the same parents, placed on it by the great spirit that made them, to keep it, to traverse it, to enjoy its productions, and to fill it with the same race, once a happy race, since made miserable by the white people, who are never contented, but always encroaching. The way, and the only way to check this evil, is for all the red men to unite in claiming a common and equal right in the land, as it was at first and should be yet. For it never was divided, but belongs to all for the use of each.
I think that our cornerstone should contain some reminder of the fact that America is and always has been a magnificent country, and that all Americans, naturalized or native, have realized this fact. Take, for example, this letter, which one immigrant wrote back to the old country in the year 1492.
All these islands are very beautiful and distinguished by diversity of scenery. They are filled with a great variety of trees of immense height, which I believe to retain their foliage in all the seasons. For when I saw them, They were as verdant and luxurious as they usually are in Spain in the month of May. Some of them were blossoming, some bearing fruit, and all flourishing in the greatest perfection according to their respective stages of growth and the nature and quality of each. Yet the islands are not so thickly wooded as to be impenetrable. The nightingale and various birds were singing in countless numbers, and that in November, the month in which I arrived there.
These words were, of course, from the letter which the Admiral of the Ocean Sea, Christopher Columbus, wrote to Don Rafael Sanchez, treasurer to their Catholic Majesties of Spain. Now, allowing for a certain elegance of diction and perhaps for the differences in languages, what does this passage remind you of? Surely of nothing quite so much as that much later American musical document called Illinois.
Away down on the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had crossed over it, this soil he'd surely own. He'd think it was a garden he'd played in when a boy, and straight pronounce it Eden in the state of Illinois. She's bounded by the Wabash, the Ohio, and the lakes. She's crawfish in the swampy lands, a milksick and the shakes. But these are slight diversions, which take not from the joy of dwelling in that garden spot, the state of Illinois. So move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and rise to wealth and honor in the state of Illinois. 'Twas here the Queen of Sheba came with Solomon of old, with a donkey's load of spices, pomegranates, and fine gold. But when she saw this lovely land, her heart was filled with joy. Straightway she said, I'd like to be the Queen of Illinois. Away up in the northward, right on the borderline, a great commercial city, Chicago, you will find. Her men are all like Abelard, her women like Eloise, all honest, virtuous people, for they live in Illinois. So move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross that Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois.
Wynn Starkey maintains that this song was probably written in the early 1800s by a real estate agent with a few choice lots to sell somewhere around the corner of State and Madison. It may be true. If there are two major factors in America's growth, they are the land and perhaps after that the weather. I mention weather partly because I've always been fond of Mark Twain's celebrated speech on that topic, and partly because today I was looking in one of the many accounts of the life of that distinguished American pioneer, Feibold Feiboldson, a man who struggled vigorously and more or less successfully against the vicissitudes imposed on him by the American weather.
There's only one place where you can get real, genuine American weather, and that's on the Great Plains between the Mississippi and the Rockies. In the early days, I guess it was even more American than it is now. At least that's what Bergstrom Stromberg says. He's way past 90 and has seen some pretty big weather in his day. Besides, he's heard all about the climate of the early days directly from his uncle, the famous Feibold Feiboldson. Feibold was the first white settler west of the Mississippi, not counting the Spaniards and Frenchmen. Now, you take the popcorn ball. There's a genuine American product. Most people think that somebody invented the popcorn ball, but it's actually a product of the American weather. It invented itself, so to speak, on Bergstrom Stromberg's ranch in the early days when old Feibold owned the place. It was during that peculiar year known as the Year of the Striped Weather, which come between the years of the big rain and the great heat. Well, this year, the weather was both hot and rainy. There was a mild strip of scorching sunshine, and then a mild strip of rain. And it so happened that on Feibold's farm, there were both kinds of weather. The sun shone in his cornfield until the corn began to pop, while the rain washed the syrup out of his sugar cane. Now, the cane field was on a hill, and the cornfield was in a valley. And the syrup flowed downhill into the popcorn and rolled it into great big balls. Popcorn balls. Bergstrom said some of them were hundreds of feet high and looked like big tennis balls from a distance. Well, you never see any of them now, because the grasshoppers ate them up all one day, July 21st, 1874.
There is in all these stories and sayings a good deal of humor, a good deal of fantasy indulged in for the fun of it. But there is a hard truth behind the laughter. The Americans did build their country and their lives in a vast and seemingly unconquerable place. And they were, even after they had grown great in numbers and power, even after they lived in luxury rather than in hardship, a lonely people. All this is expressed in their poetry and in their songs.
I'm going away for to stay a little while, but I'm coming back, though I go 10,000 miles. And it's who will chew your foot, and it's who will glove your hand, and it's who will kiss your ruby lips when I am gone. Look away over yandro. Look away over yandro. I'm going away for to stay a little while, but I'm coming back, though I go 10,000 miles.
You have been listening to Americana, the first in a series of radio essays dealing with American history and American living, presented each week by Northwestern University in cooperation with station WMAQ. Americana is written and narrated by Martin Maloney. Direction is by Howard Keegan. Songs and ballads are by Chicago's well-known balladeer, Win Strachey. The quoted materials were read by Claire Baum and myself, Bill Griskey. The books mentioned on tonight's program were John Dos Passos, USA, published by Houghton Mifflin, and the selected works of Stephen Vincent Benet, published by Reinhardt. Additional material was from Benjamin Botkin's Treasury of American Folklore, published by Crown, and from Ina F. Wistmeyer's The Westward Movement, published by D. Appleton Century. If you wish to receive a list of the books discussed on this program, please send your name and address on a postcard to Americana, care of station WMAQ, Chicago 54, and a free copy will be sent to you. And now, here is a special announcement. Americana will be heard next Wednesday, September 30th, from 9:30 until 10 p.m., and each Wednesday thereafter at the same time. Remember, Americana, next Wednesday, and every Wednesday thereafter at 9:30 to 10. See you this next Wednesday. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.